Okay, so what Dan and I do for a living is we work mostly for boards. We also work for management teams occasionally. Been in thousands of board meetings, mostly compensation committee meetings, advising on everything from everything that relates to kind of how the top of the house is paid. Be the annual bonus programs, it could be the long-term incentive programs, it could be bringing in a new CEO and helping the board do a contract negotiation. It could be overall use of equity for the entire company, because the board is typically responsible for overall equity use as well. But we're limited to working for boards, so we're mostly working for boards, so we don't provide other services to companies so that we stay independent. We always report directly to the board, and we obviously have to work with the management team to help the board understand how to attract, retain, and motivate an executive team. What we put together today that we could use as a discussion guide if we want to follow this is just a case example, and we could talk about kind of what's on here, but we can also go sideways or backwards and talk about whatever you want. I'm happy to share anything you'd like to know about the world of executive compensation consulting, how, you know, relating to governance, relating to how the work is actually done, relating to our relationship with the relationship between us and management and the committee, about the dual, there's sometimes there are dueling consultants where management has its own consultant and the board has its own consultant, so I'm happy to talk about any topic, but I'll pass this around and we could start with this, and feel free to take us in any direction you'd like.
Let me just add that, given the list that you shared with us, at some point during your remarks, I'd be very interested to hear generally what you might have to say about the kind of governance issues.
Yep, about governance generally. And governance is extremely important, and there are a lot of people paying attention to executive compensation right now. You know, it's obviously a hot topic in the media. It's the proxy advisory groups like ISS and Glass Lewis continue to gain influence. ISS is kind of the 900-pound gorilla and is driving a lot of the executive comp discussion these days. I'll definitely talk about those as we talk about the case study. Is there anything else that, like, off the bat you want to make sure that I cover, or you want to just interrupt me as we go along?
I enjoy interrupting people.
People are not shy.
Just only mid-sentence, though. Not when I'm breathing in between. So the case study that I just handed out, this is a made-up scenario of a combination of lots of different things that I've seen. And so for purpose of the discussion, assuming you're on the comp committee of a $1.5 billion revenue, about a $5 billion market cap med device company, new CEO named Mary. She started last month. She got a $10 million equity package to start. It was intended to cover 3 years worth of grants, 3 years worth of equity grants. There are half stock options, half restricted stock. She has a guaranteed bonus for 2 years, and then after that, her bonus would be tied half to the company's financials and half to her personal objectives. An employment contract that has automatic acceleration of vesting on a change of control. She's concerned about attracting and retaining top talent. She's concerned that maybe her top talent isn't well enough retained because they didn't pay an annual bonus recently. They just got a ISS report. Is everyone familiar with ISS? ISS, it's Institutional Shareholder Services. They are the largest proxy advisory group out there. So they advise a lot of investment houses on how to vote on issues that come up in proxies. So they don't just advise on executive comp, they advise on board structure and some other things. What we're focused on and the comp committee is focused on is executive compensation. Their business model is they advise these financial institutions on how to vote on such things like if a company is requesting additional shares for their equity pool to be able to give to executives and employees, ISS will advise its clients on how to vote on the that issue. They advise on how to vote on say on pay. So public companies now every 1, 2, or 3 years have to basically put out a non-binding vote to its shareholders to see if the shareholders ratify or approve of the way they're paying the top executives. ISS advises on that. They also do consulting on the other side of the house, so it gets a little bit confusing exactly where they fit.
Do they have a conflict of interest?
I was going to ask the same. I'm a little late to the table, sorry. That's been troubling to me. It's a public company. It advises both sides. There's no benefit for them not to have conflict in this. I mean, how does that work?
It has there have been multiple congressional threats to regulate them because they're really two big companies. It's ISS and Glass Lewis. ISS is much more influential than Glass Lewis. If they do negative recommendation on say on pay, it's probably going to cost you 20% of your votes, 20 percentage points. They claim to have, you know, a solid wall between their research side, which actually looks at public company proxies and reads through them and makes, you know, gives advice on whether to approve an equity plan or whether to how to vote on say on pay. And then they, on the other side of the wall, are the consulting folks who advise on how to pass this. And there are a lot of, there's certainly been a lot of commentary about the conflict of interest and the potential for conflict of interest, especially because they don't make money on the research side. The money that they make is on the consulting side. And so, you know, I haven't been in, I'm in 100 board meetings a year. I haven't been in a board meeting in probably 3 years where ISS has not come up, where ISS comes up all the time. And directors have perspectives on ISS that range from whatever ISS says we have to do, to I don't care what ISS says, and then everything in between. But I haven't heard a lot of kind words about what they do, because they try to standardize everything to a point that you can have, you know, a very junior person analyze a proxy, and a lot of compensation programs are very complicated. It's hard to fit them into the ISS box, you know, as far as how they do their scoring, et cetera. But that conflict has been discussed quite a bit, and there's a panel now, I think, that...
Yeah, I think there's a lot of discussion. They were just sold again. For like the fifth time in 8 years or something. And they, I think the problem is they can't split them up where the research side goes under, because then it's not profitable.
Can I make 3 points? One is, ISS has actually been around. I've been dealing with them since 1992. This is not new. Although it's in the last 10 years, it's gotten
much more powerful.
Yeah, and which brings me to my second point. And the reason they're so powerful is that folks with large institutional votes rely on them. And so they enable them to be powerful, if you think about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's an enabler. Third, there have been enough complaints that the SEC, from what I've heard from the audit side, have actually started to look at them. What happens out of that, I don't know.
Yeah.
Having been with Arthur Anderson, is it the SEC that is enforcing the public audit firms to separate their audit business and their consulting business?
The SEC did that through Sarbox.
Yeah.
And it happened in our industry. It hasn't been regulated. It is to some extent. There's now consultant independence rules, and there's six factors that a company has to look at. They're not hard and fast rules, but it relates to, do I provide other services to the company? So the big HR houses, Mercer and Towers Watson, used to have very big executive compensation practices, but they'd be doing $150,000 or $200,000 worth of exec comp work for a company, but they'd have $1 million actuarial relationship. So the board hires them for the $150,000 to $200,000 worth of work to decide how to pay the top executives. The top executives are making the decision on who is going to get the $1 million worth of actuarial. And that's very much split now. And the firms are already independent. Fred Cook, Perlmeyer are now the largest two firms. They used to be smaller compared to these big HR firms, but most of the exec comp consultants fled those companies, because what happened once they couldn't do both services, what are you going to give up, $1 million, or you're going to give up $150,000? So they're losing all their clients. So then they came to the boutiques. They formed some new boutiques. Pay Governance LLC was a spin out from Wyatt. There's Meridian was a spin out from Hewitt. It's pretty hard and fast now. Anyone who wants to do public company advising around executive comp, the only you're going to do exec comp, you do director comp, and you're pretty much not going to do anything else. That's it. So it's a bunch of boutiques in the business now. It's probably a $500 million. The whole business is probably a $500 million business. We're the largest firm at, you know, in $60, $70 million. So they've talked about regulating it more, but have not. Other than the independent, you know, putting these factors around independence and requiring independence, and that came out of Dodd-Frank. So where were we?
They just received an ISS report.
What's that?
They just received an ISS report.
Yeah, so ISS basically is recommending a no vote on say on pay because there's misalignment between the former CEO's pay and company performance. Excessive perks, lack of risk mediators like stock ownership guidelines, hedging pledging policy, and a clawback policy, and then lack of performance-based equity. These are kind of some hot buttons.
Could you tell us, I mean, all of these I'm familiar with except for one, hedging pledging policy?
This is one of their,
I missed
hedging is you know, basically taking your securities and hedging against your own stock. And then pledging would be to take your, using your security, your own security, and pledging it, you know, on a margin account or pledging it for something else. So a lot of companies have anti-hedging, not many have the anti-pledging yet. But if you don't have them, ISS, you get a mark for not having them. The clawback one's been interesting too, because Dodd-Frank, there are a bunch of exec comp rules in Dodd-Frank. One of them is going to be a mandated clawback. But the clawback I'm talking about, let's say you pay a bonus, and then there's a financial restatement, and then how do you go about taking money back from the executives who are paid on erroneous financial statements, and how do you take equity back if the stock went up because of erroneous financial, people cash out, and the stock goes down once the restatement is done. Dodd-Frank has, there's a law around clawbacks, but it hasn't been, the regs haven't been written by the SEC yet. So a lot of companies were waiting to implement a clawback because they didn't want to put one clawback in and then have the SEC come out with different rules. But now it's gotten to the point the SEC has been sitting on this for 2 years.
October, or so they say.
Yeah, so for 2 years now. So now a lot of companies are just, they're adopting the clawback policies because they're getting hit by ISS if they don't have it.
So in this case, we're talking about clawback of stock and cash comp?
Yeah.
So right now there's no specific instruction on what the clawback has to improve. It's generally incentive pay, and the unclarity still with what Dodd-Frank will add above and beyond what Sarbox required, which is just in, you know, like knowing misconduct or fraudulent activity. That's where it's still unclear what it's going to apply to and what to do.
But the law generally, the way it reads, it doesn't matter whether you were a bad actor or not, and it's a 3-year look back. And it's all incentive pay, which would include equity. So there's a lot of comment letters to the SEC to say, this isn't practical. How are we going to do this? So we'll have to see how the regulations actually come out and define it. But this has been very difficult for companies to decide, what do we do for a clawback? You know, the key questions on it are, do we require wrongdoing, or is it any restatement? And then what do we actually claw back, and how far back do we go? So. But a lot of companies have put something in now just to kind of check the box. I mean, it's logical to have a clawback. I mean, it's a reasonable thing to do. It's just the details of it are very difficult. You know, how do you actually do it when, you know, somebody, they already cashed out, they already bought a motorcycle and a vacation house, and now you go trying to collect a couple hundred thousand dollars on equity? What's that?
What if they've left the company?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. And so right now, the law doesn't deal with any of that. That's what the regs are going to have to deal with. What's that?
If it's not connected to bad behavior, I think you'll see people leaving the companies.
Yeah.
That's but the blocks are too big.
Yep. So those are kind of some facts that we put out there, and then we have some we're going to have a compensation committee meeting to talk about peer group approval. I don't know how many of you worked in the whole peer group world. This is a very, very controversial area, how peer groups are defined, whether peer groups are appropriate, because basically what peer groups are used for is to set executive pay, the top five executives. They're used, for the top five executives, they're used for equity dilution, to have an idea how much equity are you using compared to your peers, and they can be used for pay practices. So you might look at your peers and say, okay, well, what's their short-term incentive plan look like? What does their long-term incentive plan look like? And there used to be, we talk here that Mary, the new CEO, she wants to use an aspirational peer group because her plan is to double the company in 5 years, and so she doesn't want to hire talent for a $1.5 billion company. She wants to hire talent for a $3 billion company, and that's one of the discussion topics. Another discussion topic is on the ISS report, a little bit about shareholder outreach, and then Mary's proposing to do some retention grants.
I'm just wondering if you could give an example of what Mary's aspirational peers might be.
So, an aspirational, what she would propose would be, normally what you do when you create a peer group, you're defining what the selection criteria are going to be on the front end. So typically it's going to be size and industry are the two big ones. Industry obviously, you want companies in a similar industry. Size, it could be based on revenue, it could be based on market cap. If it's a financial institution, it could be based on assets. The strongest correlation between exec comp and anything is revenue. Market cap is so volatile that it's hard to use market cap. You might look at market cap to rev ratios, you might look at number of employees, but essentially you predefine how you're going to select the peer group, and then the consultant, the independent consultant, really works with the board and the management team to define who those peers are going to be. And you're trying to, you're going to have, you're never going to find any company that's exactly like you. But what you want to do is end up with a company that has a group of companies, 12 or more. Typically, the average is probably about 16, 17 companies. And you want the median revenue to be around where you are. So you've got bigger companies and smaller companies. Same thing with market cap to rev ratios, maybe a number of employees. If it's a tech or a life sciences, it might be R&D spend. But what happens if you get too many selection criteria, you just run out of companies. So the big ones tend to be industry, revenue, market cap to rev ratio, and maybe employees. I'd say those are probably the most common. We'll have some companies who are high growth, so they want to look at 1 and 3 year growth metrics and that type of thing. So an aspirational peer group might be, they're sitting at, her company's sitting at $1.5 billion, but a peer group is created that has a median revenue of $3 billion. So that's who we want to be. So we want to pay like them. And one of the questions we have in here, what do you think about that? Is that appropriate? You want to start with that one?
Well, that was actually the question I was going to ask, because that seems to be the single biggest fight that goes on that I've been in the middle of.
Is peer group selection. And
exactly. And is it who we are today, or within a range, but who we are today versus where we plan to be in 3 years?
Right.
Given we have to attract executives, we have to retain executives, and we need people who are A players who will get us there. And it's a battle.
It's kind of shaken out in the last couple of years. It used to be a lot of companies had a kind of a size appropriate peer group and then an aspirational peer group. Aspirational peer groups are kind of a bad word now. ISS is very focused on your peer group. Investors will look at the peer group. There are academic studies around peer groups and influence of peer groups. The peer group is supposed to be picked without reference to compensation. So it's other characteristics. You can't cherry pick companies like, I want these seven companies in my peer group because they pay really well. That's part of our job, is to make sure that there isn't any cherry picking, that it really is an appropriate group. The whole argument and discussion around, well, we need, $3 billion executives when we're a $1.5 billion company. The reality is that you're only pricing the only jobs that really come out of the peer group are the top five, because that's the publicly disclosed information in a proxy are only the top five executives. Every other executive that's priced is done with survey data, with much broader survey data. And the argument that, well, we should use, you know, we're a billion-dollar company, we should use a $5 billion company because we hire engineers from them, that doesn't hold water, because that's not who the peer group is used to price. It's only the top executives. So we hear a lot, well, we hire engineers from them, we compete with them for talent. No. Who you compete with for executive talent? Is a CFO of a $5 billion company going to take a job at a $500 million company? Probably not. So it's really, what is that? Who are you competing for from a talent perspective just in that small top group? And so because of that, most of the peer groups are now pretty size appropriate because of the pressure of ISS, and you don't see a lot of aspirational peer groups. Or if there is an aspirational peer group, it's not called that. It'll be called, peer practices group. Like, you want to look at, we're not going to use it for pay. We're not going to set pay based on how this much bigger company pays. But we do want to know, what is their strategy? Like, how do they actually design their incentive programs? If that's the kind of company we want to be, there's nothing wrong with that, you know, designing your programs, but it is inappropriate to try and peg your compensation to a much bigger company for top execs.
So what is the frequency of reconstructing the peer group?
We look at it every year.
Every year?
Every year, but, you know, it's usually tweaking every year. It depends on the industry, too. You know, we're doing a life sciences, and we have a bunch of biotechs and pharmas. You know, four or five will be gone by the time you get a year rolls around. If it's a big, stable industry, then there might not be as much tweaking. And then usually maybe every other year, you take a deeper dive. I'd say, you know, when things change materially for the company, you know, when companies, kind of when they double in size, that's when exec comp changes dramatically. Like a $250 million company's pay is, at $500 million, it's a lot different. And then at $1 billion, it's a lot different than a $500 million company.
Could you have had aspirational group as a norm with the clawback, so that if this progression of the next 5 years isn't achieved, compensation is adjusted accordingly? Wait until the end of the fifth year.
Right.
Mary makes it to the year. And if the goal of becoming the whatever X billion dollar company isn't achieved, then the comp is retrospectively adjusted down to what it should have been.
Yeah, I think I don't think that would fly publicly.
It is actually set up something like that, but it's sort of under a different lens. So often they'll give a grant up front and say, this is only going to vest if you hit these goals within the 5 years. So it's like you have the opportunity for this $5 million grant, but if you don't hit the goals, you're not going to get anything.
And there's a
general sentiment, but...
There's a lot heavier use of performance equity now.
Yeah, MetLife, probably many companies, have got a executive comp plan that adjusts that way. They're stretch goals, and you can get from, I don't know, like 50% to 200% of the target.
Yep. Very, very common.
We brought a report. Our firm does a big and very, very thorough, extensive report every year on the top companies and what they're doing in terms of long-term incentive practices. The reason we look at the top companies is because they're really setting the bar. They're ahead of the curve, and everyone will be there in a few years. You can see over the last few years, the use of performance-based equity has increased dramatically. And a really, really substantial portion of the biggest companies are giving performance-based awards like that.
And the most common plan now are relative TSR plans. So a lot of companies struggle to set a long-term goal. Most performance plans are 3 years. You see four and five, but most of them are three-year plans. And for companies to set absolute targets, like a revenue goal or a EBITDA goal or even a return on capital, companies struggle setting three-year goals. They struggle setting one-year goals. A lot of companies struggle with their annual bonus programs. So you're seeing more relative plans where it's, okay, if we do better than everybody else, and the relative plans tend to be around TSR. So if you might divide it up into a couple of buckets. If we're,
what does that stand for?
Total shareholder return. So basically, how your stock performs will decide how much you get.
Right. Within the little industry peer group.
Yeah. Well, no. Most companies don't use a small peer group because it's a 3-year period. There'd be too many in and outs. So you'll see, you know, the NASDAQ Biotech Index, or you might see the Russell 2000, or there are a bunch of different indices to choose from. There are some companies that will use custom peer groups, but they tend to be big. They tend to be, you know, 30, 40 companies, not like your peer group that you would use to set comp. But they would be, you know, similar industry. And what you might see on a relative TSR plan, it might be a real simple design, would be something like, you know, you compare how you did over the 3 years compared to everybody in the Russell 2000. If you were in the bottom third, you get nothing. If you were in the middle third, you get target. And if you were in the top third, you get 150% of target, or something like that.
So when you're talking about selecting peer groups, do you also simultaneously talk about the metrics to use? For example, if you have a median on a comparable company versus a 90th percentile on the 90th percentile on the comparable versus the median on the aspirational group, maybe these numbers will come out quite differently.
So if you were at the 10th percentile as compared to the peer group, you're gonna, you know, the revenue numbers are gonna be significantly skewed. I'm sorry, the compensation numbers will be significantly higher in that peer group, and then you start chasing the wrong numbers.
Right, but I'm saying that instead of trying to persuade people to use aspirational groups, you can just say I'm using 90th percentile on my comparable. And that number probably would be even higher than the median of the next level you're looking at.
Yeah, and you know, and that's there are a lot of arguments that go on around, okay, so we pick a peer group with the right median, and now what percentile do we pay at? And that, you know, your point is that, well, you could, if you wanted to try and replicate an aspirational peer group, you might pay the 90th, but you have to if whatever your targeting strategy is disclosed in the proxy, and above median targeting strategies are being beat up pretty bad right now. You know, if you're targeting 75th percentile or 80th, 90th percentile. So companies do it, especially, you see it a lot with smaller companies. You know, especially they might be at the 25th percentile of cash because they don't have cash, and they'll be at the 75th or 80th percentile in equity because it's, you know, it's really a pop opportunity. Either this company's going to go or it's not going to go, but they don't have the cash, and so, and then over time as the company grows, then both might migrate towards the median.
I guess two questions I might ask is, one, in this industry and with this particular company in this situation, is the plan for, I don't even know what this amounts to in cumulative annual growth, let's just say it's 20% per year,
yeah,
but it's probably something like
15.
Okay.
15 will do it, right? Yeah.
All right. Is that realistic in this industry and with the company that we've built? And if so, do we think the executive team required to get that kind of growth is any different from what a company that already has $3 billion in revenue would be? Because you don't really need to compete with them, especially if you're talking about the kinds of incentives that actually will benefit them if it's stock at a lower valuation as it grows.
Right.
I wouldn't see why there would be a big point in using an aspirational peer group.
Yeah, and I agree.
Okay.
We put out, you know, the aspirational peer group thing is a no-no at this point, other than for maybe pay practices, but.
But, you know, when you look at some of the people that are hired, so for instance, Biogen, when it was in trouble, had a CFO who went to Merck to be head of the CFO for Merck.
Yeah.
And then he just went to be the CFO for Celgene. Someplace along the line, somebody made some judgments. They need those. The chief counsel for Celgene was the chief counsel for Wyeth, which is a multi-billion-dollar company. So, you know, the HR person for Agerion was Celgene's HR person.
Yep.
So you're getting this kind of movement back and forth in that particular industry. I mean, computers were somewhat different. And it's really hard because you actually have to do some of that to get the understanding of commercial and other stuff. So when you're trying to manage the peer group, as an example, top five ain't quite enough because top five limits the rest. So you can tell me, yeah, if this person has to pay here, then they got to pay more than CEO, and then you have to go to the moon to show me examples. You know,
right.
It's a really complicated question, and I worry that more and more we're leveling a playing field. It's not going to have people that are able to do things.
No, it's a good question and good point because, and this is something that we have to work with boards a lot on, which is don't get too caught up in the data, okay? Generally, you want to have a median targeting strategy from an external world perspective, but when I look at, let's say we plotted, you know, here's the median, and we plot each executive, you know, I'd like to see a scatter. I want to some are up here and some are down here because they don't all perform the same. Sure. They may have it may be that your CFO is much more valuable to you than the CFOs in the peer group because they have additional skills. They're doing IR, they're running, they're like more like a CAO. There are a whole bunch of subjective factors that the board has to have the courage and the responsibility to take into account besides the data. When, you know, I have a lot of boards where we want to be safe, so we're going to mark to market. And marking to market really isn't a good business strategy. You need to take into account relative importance of the job to you, the individual's performance, sometimes it's tenure, but generally not tenure, the company's performance, and work within, you know, the data and the peer group is giving you some rails to work within. But you may be paying at the top, you may be paying at the bottom. You don't have to pay in the middle. So I agree with that completely.
I'd like to share an observation as well, too, and maybe pose a question. Having been in the mini-computer industry, almost from cradle to grave, I've been in hyper-growth situations twice. I would describe anything that's in excess of 15% compounded growth per annum for more than five years or more hyper-growth. And it really does make a difference. You know, when you're on that track, you do have to hire ahead of the curve and get people who are accustomed to managing the larger organization, or at least have the potential to. But it also makes a tremendous difference as to whether you're already on the track or whether you're trying to get on the track. If you're on that 15% per growth annum, that's one thing. If you're trying to go from normal growth or from 3 to 5% to get on that 15% track, you know, then you're going to end up with a different situation, because the people that you need to get on the compounded growth per annum track are likely to be viewed almost as terrorists, you know, by the 3% growth people when they're brought within the company.
We have three companies that we're working with right now that are doing complete management flips, because the CEO and or the owner in one situation, a new CEO in another situation, a new CEO in another situation, came in and they want to get into hyper growth, they want to do acquisitions, they want to, you know, both organic and acquisitive growth, and they don't have the horses to do it. And so they're literally flipping out almost the entire, you know, they'll have like one or two executives that can survive, and the rest they're flipping out for much more expensive executives, and to do it they're having to pay at the higher end of the ranges. The other time you see it a lot is pre-IPO companies. So, you know, you have the founders, and then as you get closer to IPO, you know, someone who could be a CFO for a private company, or a founder who was a CEO who had a really good idea, they don't transition very well sometimes into a public company setting, and then you have to kind of decide who is it that can kind of make that transition, and or where do we have to, you know, what do we have to go out and do from a hiring professional executive's perspective. And there's some tough stuff there and some really tough discussions, especially when you have founders who own, you know, a large chunk of the stock, and, you know, they want to get liquid and they want to go public, but they don't want to give up control. And it's some very, very interesting board meetings with that stuff.
Even more fun when the founder still sits on the board.
What's that?
Even more fun when the founder still sits on the board, right?
Yeah. Founders are not generally able to sit in that room and not say anything. You know, they can't help it. They ran the company, and one of the situations that we have, the founder ran the company for a long time, and, you know, the company did the 3% growth, and now they want to do a 5x in the next 5 years, and it's hard for the founder to sit in the boardroom and hear different things and different ideas and you know, let the new CEO really do what they were hired to do. So we talked about peer groups. We talked about we talked about ISS to some extent. I'm going to talk a little bit about the CEO's comp package. What do you think? So she's 50. She got $10 million. So kind of a mega grant that's designed for 3 years. It's half in options, half in restricted stock. She's guaranteed a bonus for 2 years. And then her bonus is going to be half on her personal objectives and half on company objectives. And then she has an employment contract that has 100% acceleration on change of control automatic.
Single?
What's that?
Single or double trigger?
Single trigger.
So I guess I just have two questions, because this is
What's that?
This is a surprising package from where I sit. Yes. Yeah, for a whole bunch of reasons, but having said that. Pardon me? I've done it in Dutchman, of course.
Maybe.
I guess, you know, I've never seen a CEO's bonus guaranteed unless they're brought in new to the company and it's part of a, you know, enticement in, if you will. So that's question one.
Mm-hmm.
Is am I just, you know, that's question one.
Guaranteeing multi-year bonuses is a problem.
Right. But
ISS and others have a problem with it.
But I've never seen it except when you're trying to entice someone away.
Which happens a lot. I mean, a lot of what happens, the reason you might have to do a $10 million package is because they're walking away from a bunch of equity.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to guarantee some bonus. There are some things that you might have to do. It's an arm's length negotiation, so you don't always end up in the you know, exec comp box. But
so the other question is that I'm also surprised because at least the companies I see, we do more and more that are performance-based.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just pure time-based, especially when it's restricted stock. Options, I haven't seen options be performance-based, but the restricted stock seems to be performance-based. Is that what you're actually seeing versus what's written down here?
Yeah, so this equity package would probably be problematic for a couple reasons. One, the magnitude, $10 million. You would have to be really careful and very thorough in describing and making it clear that it's a 3-year grant, not a 1-year grant, so that ISS and anyone who looks at it understands it's really $3.3 million a year for 3 years. It's not a $10 million grant. They're used to, in the old days, mega grants were very, very common. It's hard to do these now, and you have to do really good disclosure, really talk to your shareholders and make sure that they understand what you're doing and why you're doing it. Having this entire package, according to ISS, is not performance-based. They don't consider options to be performance-based, which is crazy because you don't make any money unless the stock goes up. But ISS does not consider options to be performance-based, and obviously time-vested restricted stock is not performance-based. ISS and a lot of others would want to see at least half the package in some sort of performance-based equity. What we're seeing more and more and more of is kind of a third, a third, a third. You might have a third in time-vested restricted stock. Time-vested restricted stock is more like a retention tool. You have a third in performance shares or maybe higher, and then you might have a third in options. Or you might have 50% in performance shares, 25% in options, and 25% in time-vested restricted stock. We're seeing the use of multiple instruments that have different purposes. You know, stock option, you only get paid if this stock price increases. A restricted stock, there's intrinsic value built into that. So even if the stock price goes down, there's still value. And performance shares, it could be, you know, you could leverage it up to 200% is typically what it's leveraged up to, or you could get nothing. But you can tie it to strategic goals, or you could tie it to stock price. You could do a whole bunch of different things that you could tie their performance vesting to.
You can't really guarantee a valuation of $10 million because the value would change from time to time.
On what?
On this package.
So that's actually a lot of what we do, a lot of the work we do, and a lot of discussions we have with boards is around grant me opportunity versus realizable or realized pay. So here they're given an opportunity of $10 million, but if the stock price doesn't increase, the options are all underwater. So you know, half of your initial opportunity is gone right there, and the value of your restricted stock has gone down. So if your stock price decreases by half, all of a sudden you're left with $2.5 million, and
And this is a big discussion in exec comp now, because if you look at the New York Times study or the Wall Street Journal, any of these studies that the media do, they do it off opportunity. So say this was all options, $10 million worth of options, and the stock price never goes anywhere. That executive didn't make anything. It worked. The shareholders didn't make anything, and the executive didn't make anything. But what's reported in all these studies is that $10 million.
Right.
The discussion is evolving more to now what's realizable pay and realized pay. So, you know, what is actually in the money, and what did they actually make? Some companies are starting to disclose that in their proxies. We're not recommending that clients do that yet. The clients that do it, the companies that are doing it tend to be companies that are in trouble. So, you know, they had a big grant, TSR went like this, and they need to show ISS and their investors, hey, you know, yes, it was a $5 million grant that the CEO got, but they didn't actually make any money. But the only companies that are doing it right now, for the most part, are companies that are in trouble. I think over time, we'll see it. All companies will eventually be doing it.
So Matt, on the bonus percent, you've got half tied to company financials and half tied to personal objectives. I've seen it tied to, actually most of the time what I've seen is tied to company financials. I have started to see more tied to, with a piece tied to sort of shareholder return.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never actually seen, at least recently, the CEO bonus tied to what I would call personal objectives.
We got hammered because we didn't, because we had a portion of ours had to do with, private goals, but we never really published much of that. And then we got hammered by all the outside. I was in a company that had a lot of interesting times with,
what company was it?
Genzyme, relationally, investors, and Call Icon, some others.
Yeah.
And when they start attacking you on executive comp, there's really no rules.
It's what?
There's no rules on their side.
Yeah.
So things like TSR are messy because TSR depends on when you start.
Yeah.
Of course, a company that's failed and comes back again looks like a winner.
Yeah.
And we had 27 years of 27% compound annual growth backwards. It's hard to beat that. But in the actual failed company coming back, can do it relatively easily. So the mix of these things is very tricky.
Yeah. Very true.
I mean, that's why you get disappointed sometimes in how you get the executive comp to make sense and to be able to attract the right people for a company. If you build your own team, then you set practices that ultimately doesn't let you go outside really easily.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a.
Yeah. And it would be extremely unusual to see 50% for a CEO tied to personal objectives. 100%. It's usually 100% on corporate. Usually the highest percent you'll see is 20% on individual. You might see a lot of times what you see is the CEO 100% on corporate, and then the next group of executives might be 80% corporate and 20% on MBOs or individual objectives. But as soon as you start getting it into individual objectives, first of all, you're supposed to disclose them, and you know, and they tend to be messy and not clear. And so most companies are on financials. It's, you know, ultimately you're the top executive of the company. You're responsible for the performance of the company, so you should get paid based on. You know, you don't get paid for trying hard anymore. You know, when you're lower in the organization, it might say, you know, your job is to put this nut on that, you know, on that. This bolt, and if you do that really well and you do enough of those, then we're going to pay you. It doesn't really matter how the company does, but as you know, by the time you're the top executive, you're not getting paid for trying hard anymore.
We use financials only, all corporate, and then corporate division based on the scale of the division stuff. Then they attack you in the fact you don't have personal goals. But anybody that can't do personal goals that you can meet is an idiot that should never be doing compensation, right? I mean, that's a problem. That's why people are so suspicious of personal goals.
Yeah.
And so it's a big. I think it's we'll come back to numbers again before it's all finished.
It's the personal goals tend to be that built-in discretion. Even though there are things that are listed, it's almost like built-in discretion. A lot of boards, a lot of compensation committees are afraid to use discretion, and they have discretion on annual bonus plans, but they're afraid to use it, up or down. And the reality is, this my opinion is that they should use it because it's very difficult to even set an annual goal. And you know, the board is a check. Again, it's very hard to get everything exactly right formulaically, so they should look at the end of the year and decide, did this work correctly? And have the judgment, and you exercise their judgment to decide whether it worked correctly, and if not, to make appropriate adjustments. And it can't be just, we're just going to keep pumping it up because we don't want the management team to be mad or we're afraid that they're going to leave. It has to be based on really on how the company performed. But a lot of committees really struggle with use of discretion. There's some companies that have completely discretionary plans, and the boards are comfortable, you know, going 100% discretion. But if you do that, you need about 7 pages in your proxy to explain to ISS what you're doing, so that they don't ding you for having a non-performance-based annual incentive program.
So Matt, I was surprised to hear that there are two things. One is, was there a specific period associated with the employment contract that she was signing on?
Was there?
Was there a specific period? Or
if there wasn't, it's a problem. There are a lot of evergreen contracts that are out there and that have been out there. Most new contracts that go in are max 3 years. Because the problem is, you know, like right now, one of the big issues that ISS has are golden parachute excise tax gross-ups, so 280G excise tax gross-ups. You can't put one in anymore, but you used to be able to put them in. And there are a lot of evergreen contracts that didn't have an end date, and ISS decides golden parachute excise tax gross-ups are bad, and you as a board are looking at your executive saying, we're getting hammered by ISS because you have that, but you have no leverage to take it away from them,
right?
Because it's in the contract.
Mm-hmm.
So now contracts have terms, so you have a chance as the world changes to get a, you know, fresh bites at the apple, as opposed to being stuck with something for 10, 15 years. I would say a trend generally, you're seeing fewer employment contracts anyway. You'll see built into the equity plans double trigger acceleration. So a double trigger equity acceleration is a change in control and a termination within typically 24 months of the change of control, as opposed to a single trigger. A lot of companies still have single triggers. They're out of favor with ISS now too. So this single trigger ISS isn't on the full war path on it yet, but they're on their way. They're going to, exactly what they did with golden parachute excise tax gross-ups, that's where they're heading with single triggers.
We see a lot of companies that, rather than provide individual employment contracts or letter agreements, will put in place an executive severance or change of control plan that covers the executives in that area, but then there's no employment agreement.
Right.
Who does the report on ISS's?
What's that?
Who does the report on ISS's executive compensation?
Who's on their board?
Who does the report?
I don't know. Not us.
It's curious, right? I mean,
well, they're owned by a Canadian company, and then
MCSI. And
who just bought them?
There were RiskMetrics, there were ISS, there were RiskMetrics, there were ISS, there were Graw, I don't know.
But they're private, so.
Well, they are private. Okay, so they were public for a while. Were they? One of them went public.
Yeah, they're private.
Yeah, they're private now.
They are? Okay.
So they weren't disclosing anything, right?
Yeah, they were public for a while, so yeah. I couldn't understand how they
Yeah.
What are some of the things that, that were listed in the ISS report that aren't in the background that we got? Misalignment of the former CEO's pay, company performance? Is that simply that that the previous CEO's pay was not aligned with company performance, or that the current CEO's pay is misaligned with the former CEO's pay?
No, so this is looking backwards. So ISS reports come out about now, or the last month or two, for all the calendar year companies. So ISS has three tests, quantitative tests that they use to look at CEO pay and performance alignment. One's relative degree of alignment, which is how your pay and performance align with a peer group that they create. One is the MOM, which is multiple, and median, which is what multiple is your CEO's pay of the median of ISS's peer group that they've created for you. And then the other is absolute alignment, TSR, and CEO pay. And they run these tests on public companies, and you can either get a low, medium, or high concern on each test. If you get low concern on all three, they pretty much are going to leave you alone. They don't get into all the other stuff. But if you get medium or a couple mediums or a high, then they start digging into all the other stuff. Do you have gross ups? And that's why they got into these other things. If they didn't have the CEO pay misalignment, ISS might make a comment or two about, you know, you should have hedging pledging policy, you should have stock ownership guidelines, but they're not going to recommend no. If you unless you have a really problematic pay practice, and the reality is ISS is pretty much forced all of the really problematic pay practices, the really egregious stuff, is pretty much gone. That's disappeared over the last couple of years.
So, Matt, just to focus on what you're talking about, though, what I keep hearing is when they create their peer groups, they can be peer groups that are completely different than what the company views the peer group as.
Oh, yeah.
So that used to be the case. They are now, in the past, starting last year's reports, they'll take into account the company disclosed peers. You know, they still have their own screens, but in past years, they would just say, here's your GICS code, here's your revenue, here's your market cap, here are your peers.
Right.
And now they take into account who you disclose as a peer, because there are companies that their competitors cross different GICS industries.
Right. So what you see in the reports, they have a list of companies, and the ones at the top are ones that they selected for you that you don't have in your peer group. Then there's an overlap group, and then there's ones you selected that they don't have in the group. So an investor can look at it and see, okay, and you know, here's company selected, ISS selected, and one that both selected. But that overlap has gotten bigger because ISS is taking into account who you select as peers now.
Are there any executive perks around anymore, and what ones are common and what ones are totally gone, and is mostly everything gone?
And it's mostly,
are they mostly gone?
Mostly gone.
We still see tax prep and
tax
planning because they're relatively small.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, what's that?
Pharma still has, they haven't given up all their
some. Yeah, I mean, there's still corporate use of aircraft, but you can't gross it up. So you have to pay, if you use a corporate aircraft for personal travel, then you have to pay the tax on it. If you do a gross up, you get slammed. When I talk to boards about ISS and governance generally and perquisites and kind of where we are and where we're going, I always put things into three buckets. There's stuff that if you keep doing it, you're going to just constantly have a problem, and you got to decide whether it's worth continuing to fight the fight, okay? But it isn't going away. I mean, this is going to continue to be an issue. Then there's stuff that's percolating. It's going to be an issue at some point, but the heat isn't quite high enough yet. But you need to be aware that you may have to get rid of a single trigger at some point. You need to be aware that, you know, at some point they may force you to figure out how to get out of the golden parachute excise tax gross-ups. And then you have stuff that's just noise. And you got to be able to, you got to understand which is in which bucket, because sometimes you have a comp committee spending all their time on the noise instead of on the stuff that really matters. And so it's really important to understand, be able to put stuff in context. I talk a lot about, a big part of our job is directors read when they fly to meetings. They read stuff. And they walk into a compensation committee meeting, and a lot of times they'll throw something up against the wall that nobody, they'll say, you know, I read that, you know, a lot of companies, or, you know, we really should be looking at mandatory hold till retirement on all equity. And they throw that up against the wall, and everybody looks at it and goes, what do we do with that? Is that, you know, the management team doesn't want, you know, you're respectful of a director, and they have asked a question. A big part of our job is to say, you know what, there are some companies that are doing that, but we kind of scrape it off the wall and say, but that's really in this third bucket right now. Nobody in your industry, nobody your size is doing it, and if you tried to do it, you wouldn't have any executives. So let's get that off the table. And there are a lot of things like that that just come up, and that we try, when I think about comp committee meetings also, efficiency is important. You only meet for a couple hours a couple times a year, and you're trying to make very important decisions that impact, you know, very subjective areas, and you need to make sure that when you're in those comp committee meetings, you're focused on the right issues and not talking about the stuff that doesn't matter.
We have 5 minutes because we started a little late, so we'll give you a 5 minute warning.
Is hold to retirement in fact used in cases?
We're seeing a little bit.
You know, there are a few really big companies that have some in place, and so there's been some measure on that. You know, Yum Brands, they started a new trend a few years ago.
I worked for Citibank in the 1980s, and John Reed, a couple of years after he took the chairmanship, adopted pretty much all of the incentive comp was Citicorp stock with hold to retirement, and that lasted for 1 year.
Yeah,
because all the execs threatened to quit.
Yep. Yeah, that's a tough one, but you know, there's a lot of folks in the media who think it's a good idea. You know, and
it's except to the people.
But it's hard to be a compensation committee member right now. I mean, there's just a lot coming at you from a lot of different directions, and you have to make some hard decisions.
So one thing that's really a problem is that the more visible your board members were or their comp committee members are, the more you have to worry about their reputational sensitivities. As an example, one of our guys got singled out because of a vote that had been done that was showed. And then they came back and said they want to vote for, again, Glass Lewis and one of those. So it's tricky about your board members really are sensitive to the, you know, like what Richard Zalvey had was Duke Medical Center. These are guys, or Connie Mack, who was a senator. They just don't like stuff that gets messy.
Right.
And so you have to be very clear about, so the comp committee stuff has to be careful anyway, but things that are controversial have another level is they don't want to be newspapers. And that's the place where it's
One of the things that I've seen are comp committee members who are on multiple boards can be afraid to make business decisions that would be controversial with investors or with ISS because they're afraid how it's going to impact their membership on other boards. And it's important to be aligned with your investors. It's important to know what ISS is saying. But at the end of the day, you got to run your business and you got to do what's right for the business. And I mean, the rails within which you can work are pretty wide. But you can get close to the rails, but some board members get very uncomfortable, especially if they're worried about either reputational risk because of who they are, or they're worried about how decisions they make might impact the other boards that they're on.
One of the questions you put on here, I'll ask it maybe a different way, which is if Frank is one of your junior consultants and is working for you, when do you say to Frank, you know what, Frank, you should leave. You should let them now sort this out. You've done what you can. Or do you say stay there till they've got everything down on paper and made all their decisions?
I like that one.
So you're talking about in the
compensation, consultant. Yeah, as a consultant in either presenting to or observing and contributing to the discussion, when does Frank say, all right, guys, I got to leave you to make the decision, or does he sit there and continue to provide advice?
We're there to the end. We're not necessarily talking, because an important part of our job is to know when to facilitate, when to educate, when to advocate, which is rare. The only time we advocate is if somebody's going to do something really stupid, and when to shut up, because a lot of times things have to evolve. The directors have to talk, and we have to have the experience and the maturity to know what our role is. We're advisors. We're not making the decisions, but we are there till the very end, because we're, you know, almost every compensation committee meeting will have an executive session after, and they want, you know, the it's good governance practice for to have executive session, and also for the directors to be able to talk to the consultant without management in the room. Now you hope that you're not in situations where, you know, you're only willing to say something to the board that you wouldn't say in front of management. It's rare that would happen, but there could be situations where the board and management are disagreeing and we're on a different page too, and then they want to have a conversation with us without management present. Or so we're there till the end.
A little bit of color. They don't let Frank in the room until he knows when to talk.
Thank you very much. And if anybody wants to stay and continue the conversation, are you guys going to be here for a bit?
Yep, absolutely.
Great. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Shut this off now?
Yeah, now I can talk really.